This is Vladivostok, the largest Russian city on the Pacific Ocean. Vladivostok is home to a number of unique attractions, including one of the country's only two funiculars, commissioned as part of a 1959 plan to build Soviet San Francisco, impressive bridges built for the 2012 APEC summit, and one of the world's largest aquariums. But perhaps its most unusual attraction is something you won't find listed on any travel guide. Repair Korea, an exclusively North Korean contractor specializing in home repair and renovation. Its website, translated here to English, acknowledges your skepticism. Some people think you shouldn't invite Koreans to repair your apartment, but reassures you that, quote, unlike spoiled Russian specialists, Koreans work extremely professionally, accurately, and in full compliance with world quality standards. But don't assume North Korean builders are confined to any one construction niche. Others helped build the World Cup Stadium in St. Petersburg and apartment buildings in Moscow. Neither do they work only in Russia. After the US State Department commended the country of Kuwait for cutting ties with North Korea, Kuwait responded with confusion, saying there are no plans to expel North Korean laborers, and Kuwait has never done so. The regime collects the vast majority of these wages, while recipient nations get access to cheap, hardworking labor. This trade is often cited as proof that sanctions don't work. It seems there's always a way around them. After the UN demanded that countries expel North Korean workers in 2017, for instance, Russia simply reissued them tourist and student visas. The country is also responsible for countless hacking campaigns, ransomware attacks, the production of counterfeits, and a dozen other illicit odd jobs. But, in fact, the opposite. The extreme lengths it goes to evade sanctions, even when the payoff is relatively small, suggests they do have a powerful effect. And yet, there hasn't been any meaningful diplomatic progress in decades. So why do sanctions bring Iran to the negotiating table, but not North Korea? Sponsored by CuriosityStream and Nebula. Get both and watch the bonus video that accompanies this one for just $15 a year. North Korea has sought nuclear weapons, with varying degrees of urgency, for its entire existence. In 1959, just 6 years after the end of the Korean War, the Soviet Union agreed to build it a reactor, though not without conditions. The Soviets pressured them to sign the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which they finally did in 1985. But inconsistencies emerged almost immediately. After signing the treaty, countries are required to submit an initial report in which they declare how much nuclear material is already in their possession. North Korea waited 7 years to do so, and international inspectors soon noticed a discrepancy in the amount of declared plutonium. It then refused to allow further inspections, withdrew from the treaty, and even neglected its binding commitments. But this was only the first of many broken promises to come. In 1994, after 4 months of negotiations, the US agreed to give it 2 light water reactors and 500,000 tons of fuel oil annually in exchange for the freezing of its weapons program. Then North Korea was caught secretly enriching uranium, and according to the US, even admitted to it. A new round of negotiations began in 2003, which appeared to reach a breakthrough. Nuclear facilities were dismantled, and the country was removed from America's list of state sponsors of terrorism. Predictably, North Korea announced it would restart its nuclear program several years later. At this point, no doubt remained about its true intentions. Dishonesty had been demonstrated time and time and time again. Perhaps even more worrisome was its long history of sporadic and dangerous behavior. This includes multiple attempted assassinations of the South Korean president, airplane bombs, the 1968 capture of an American ship, and firing at both military and civilian planes. And when the carrot fails, conventional wisdom would suggest it's time for the stick. Sanctions were the only option left, it seemed, for a country that couldn't be trusted. Over time, they expanded from covering military equipment to travel, luxury goods, raw materials, and even food, severely restricting even basic humanitarian aid. But just as negotiation appeared less and less effective over time, sanctions have now been around long enough to identify a pattern. They don't work. The problem is not, contrary to popular thinking, that sanctions are easily evaded. In 2017 and 18, a decline in trade led to a 3.5 and 4.1% decrease in its GDP. Exports declined by 90% in 2018. Of course, neither are they perfectly effective. Far from it. There will always be black markets and someone else with a vested interest in North Korea's continued existence. China, for instance, supplies its neighbor with just enough coal, oil, and food to prevent its collapse, the vacuum of which would soon be filled by an American ally. This measly income is akin to an unemployed person recycling bottles and cans. It's not nothing, but pretty close at the scale of a nation. To put things in perspective, North Korea's GDP is half that of Vermont's, the US state with the smallest economy. Yet its population is 40 times larger. The problem is that sanctions don't work as intended. They clearly haven't ended its nuclear program or put an end to missile tests. The first reason is that the wrong people are affected. The only group whose suffering might induce change are elites, yet the burden of sanctions is mostly felt by the middle class and below. As inflation increases, average working-class households struggle to maintain the same standard of living. High sanction-driven prices mean that 97% of Afghanistan will fall below the poverty line this year, according to a UN estimate. When the rich and powerful are affected, they can simply cut back on social programs to compensate. Now, you might argue this is how things are supposed to work. The civilian population puts pressure on the government, and the threat of losing power encourages it to change course. But this effect is strongest in democracies, which sanctioned countries are less likely to be. North Korea, on the other hand, goes well beyond less democratic. It's the textbook example of a country unlikely to experience political revolution. Insulated from the rest of the world in virtually every respect, it can easily control the narrative, blaming higher prices and lower quality of life on the enemy. If anything, sanctions have the opposite effect. Just as residents of Yugoslavia blamed the UN, not their own government, in the 90s, they instill a unifying patriotism among North Koreans. Again, the net effect of sanctions for its leaders is unquestionably negative. They lead to malnutrition, death, disease, population decline, and, ultimately, economic failure. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the regime's closest ally, between 600,000 and 1 million Koreans died of hunger. While sanctions were not the direct cause, they certainly didn't help. Even if you believe these deaths mean nothing to Kim Jong-un, the axis of evil label diminishes the country's legitimacy. It desperately wants to be treated like a normal country. This is evidenced, according to many experts, by the continuous cycle of missile tests, which are followed by demands for negotiation. Despite having long ago demonstrated its nuclear capabilities, it's nevertheless discontent with the status quo. So we're seemingly back to square one. If it wants sanctions lifted, why doesn't it strike a deal? To answer this question, try putting yourself, no matter how unnatural it may feel, in the shoes of Kim Jong-un, whose number one fear is regime change. This deeply held fear is not Stalinist paranoia or an archaic leftover of the Soviet era. Kim Jong-un has every legitimate reason to worry. After all, none of this is theoretical. Libya acceded to US demands, halting the development of its nuclear program in 2003. 8 years later, the dead body of Muammar Gaddafi was on public display. Just in case the lesson that an autocrat should never surrender his weapons of mass destruction wasn't made clear enough, American officials have since made repeated, unequivocal threats that the same thing could happen to Kim Jong-un. In the lead-up to the 2018 Singapore summit, for instance, President Trump warned that his North Korean counterpart would suffer the same fate as Gaddafi if a deal wasn't reached. US, South Korean, and Japanese forces regularly conduct mock decapitation drills on its doorstep. And in 2006, former Secretary of Defense William Perry published an op-ed titled, "If Necessary, Strike and Destroy." None of this, obviously, absolves North Korea of any responsibility. Its negotiating behavior has ranged from merely skittish to downright deceitful. But in truth, the US has also given it plenty of genuine reason for skepticism. What the simplistic version of events, suggesting North Korea never intended on following through on its promises, from earlier, misses is the lack of American political continuity. The 1994 agreed framework, when North Korea was caught secretly enriching uranium, for example, is remembered as a failure. While its actions certainly violated the spirit of the agreement, it did suspend production of plutonium, as promised, which was a significant step in the right direction. Also missing is that the Clinton administration completed a review of US policy on September 15, 1999, recommending, quote, a new comprehensive and integrated approach to negotiations. But that radical new approach never came to fruition, because George Bush won the presidency 14 months later. Bush began his own policy review, which took another year, and ended by effectively suspending the agreed framework. Now, the US had every right to withdraw from its side of the agreement. After all, North Korea had clearly violated it first. But in doing so, it let North Korea off the hook for everything, allowing it to resume production of plutonium. Not only did America willfully lose the little bit of progress it had made, it also permanently diminished the very currency of negotiations. Trust. Again, blame lies squarely in North Korea's court, but one can easily see how America's actions would inspire less than supreme confidence in Pyongyang. In addition to the lack of political continuity, which leads countries around the world to doubt America's long-term commitments and think they can simply wait it out for a new administration, there's also the issue of funding. Presidents can negotiate, but only Congress controls the purse. When the two branches disagree, commitments made by the president may be broken. The other country won't care whose exact fault it is, only that the promise was broken. Another neglected aspect of the agreed framework were the delays. Angry that the US was, quote, rewarding the enemy with fuel, oil, and two light water reactors, which cannot be used to build nuclear weapons, Congress withheld funding, which led North Korea to doubt its sincerity. A lot has changed in the last 30-some years. Aside from a few brief pauses here and there, North Korea has continued improving its capabilities. From possessing one or two bombs, to missile delivery, hydrogen bombs, ballistic missiles, and most recently, long-range road mobile ballistic missiles capable of reaching anywhere on the US mainland. And yet, the US still demands the exact same thing it did in 1990. Complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization. Its bottom line is that North Korea abandoned 30 years of development, economic sacrifices, and, likely, the only thing keeping Kim Jong-un alive. If this was ever a realistic demand, it stopped being one decades ago. Each successive American president arrives fresh in the White House believing they can be the one to finally resolve the crisis once and for all. But they soon discover that there are only two possible pathways. Either be forever known as the one to accept that it's too late, that North Korea is and will remain a nuclear power, that there's nothing the US can do about it, and risk being perceived as soft on the enemy of all enemies, or accept nothing less than the only thing Kim Jong-un won't ever agree to, complete denuclearization. Setting themselves up to fail from the very beginning. If the goal is merely to punish, the United States has unquestionably succeeded. But more likely, having an effect has been confused with effectiveness. The irony is that by refusing to accept even 1% risk, America must now accept much more than 1% risk. The world's most powerful country cannot cope with the fact that the one country beyond its control has an economy the size of Mozambique, and a leader whose most discernible personality trait is a passion for Swiss cheese. So accustomed to having the final say, the ability to kill any leader of any country at any time, the US is almost perfectly ill-suited to deal with a country where such threats are exactly the cause of angst, and therefore bad behavior in the first place. So, what's the solution? And is North Korea an exception, or are economic sanctions vastly overrated? Both these questions are the subject of the bonus video that accompanies this one on Nebula, the creator-owned streaming platform. By signing up for Nebula, you get access to a dozen other Polymatter bonus videos and extended content, exclusive originals, and for the same low price, CuriosityStream. CuriosityStream is home to great documentaries on history, science, and technology. Another country that struggled under the weight of US sanctions is Cuba, but the lack of tourists has turned its natural environment into an untouched experiment. This documentary explores that dilemma. Can Cuba keep its beaches pristine, or will it eventually succumb to financial pressure? Click the link on screen right now to get both Nebula and CuriosityStream for just $15 a year, and go watch the bonus video over on Nebula.